I'm Chris Pediscalzo.
I'm Matt Howell.
And this is the inaugural episode, the first run of the first run.
So it begins.
Welcome to the fantastic world of Mr. Fox.
Woo! Should we dance?
Woo! His life is fantastic.
Pure wild animal craziness.
His wife is fantastic.
If what I think is happening, it better not be.
His neighbors. Not so fantastic.
This is Bogus, Bunce, and Bean, three of the meanest, nastiest, ugliest farmers in his valley.
What was that?
They're digging us up!
But they're about to discover...
Oh, Foxy, is help on the way?
He's one fox.
I've got an idea.
You can't out-fox.
Mole, what do you got?
I can see in the dark.
We can use that. Rabbit, I'm fast. Badger!
Demolitions expert.
What? Since when? Here, put these bandit hats on.
I don't have a bandit hat, but I modified this tube sock.
We look good.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, Matt. This is the first episode, and here we go. I got a question for you. After the promise shown in Bottle Rocket, the greatness that is Rushmore, and what some consider his best film, The Royal Tannenbaums, Wes Anderson has seemed to have fallen in love, maybe a little too much, with his own style, his own quirk, if you will. In the, I'd say, agreeable Life Aquatic, and perhaps the not-so-agreeable Darjeeling Limited, perhaps we've seen some diminishing returns. So let me ask you a question. In our review of The Fantastic Mr. Fox, has Wes Anderson redeemed himself? And in your eyes, did he even have to?
Wow. That is a question that I really have to ponder. I like the Fantastic Mr. Fox. I mean, I think, Wes Anderson, I mean... With the Darjeeling Limited, yes, it was a hiccup, but, you know, every filmmaker is going to have one of those. You can't be perfect or even great or even good all the time. And it wasn't really a bad movie, but I think that this was actually a very good Wes Anderson showing. If you like Wes Anderson, you will like this movie.
That's an interesting point, that it's not, even just to go back to Darjeeling, that though it maybe not be in the top shelf of his films, it's still a good film, especially if you're a Wes Anderson fan.
Right.
I would agree with that. And I would agree as well that The Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think, is another great addition to the Wes Anderson library, if you will. And as you said, I would totally agree. If you're a Wes Anderson film fan, you will enjoy this movie. Honestly, initially, I was a little apprehensive about seeing the movie. I'm not typically that much into animated films unless there's a Pixar in the front of the title.
Right.
I was a little concerned, too, about being able to see this film with the Fantastic Mr. Fox and not see George Clooney the entire time. As you may know, George Clooney does play the central character. He voices, I should say, Mr. Fox. But after about 10 minutes, he disappeared from the role. I was now, at that point, just Fox. And some other performances I thought were quite good. No, at the beginning it kind of annoyed me, but again, I got into it, was Jason Schwartzman as his son, Ash. And then, of course, Willem Dafoe, who was the assassin, Rat, who was the bodyguard for one of the farmers. I enjoyed him a lot. In fact, one thing, too, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but I loved the play between Rat and Fox,
yeah.
The conversations they would have, the insults he would volley over to Fox about his wife,
right.
Which I thought were
the implied
quite
history.
Amusing. Yes.
Between the two of them.
And one of my favorite scenes, and though we don't want to get into an issue, we don't want the show to become essentially like, that scene was awesome. Wasn't that cool? That kind of, but the fight scene between Fox and Rat in the sewers with the electricity whenever it was...
Strobe light.
Thank you. The strobe light effect, which was very well done. And another thing I really enjoyed was the score homages to Sergio Leone. There's a lot of standoff scenes between Fox and Rat and the farmers,
mm-hmm.
and they really kind of harken back to those old Sergio Leone films, which I'm, of course, a big fan of. One thing I wanted to point out, too, that I thought was really interesting is how there's the second film this year that is a kid's film that's really made for adults.
Right.
The previous one being Where the Wild Things Are, a movie that I was underwhelmed by. I'm not a big fan of. I loved that book when I was a kid, and it just didn't work for me. It was too heavy. It was too dark.
Yeah.
Lots of adult themes. And granted, I understand what they're going for and what Spike Jonze was trying to say with that movie. But essentially, it was too heavy. Where the Wild Things Are was just too heavy for me. And then how essentially like all the monsters in the movie were just different aspects of Max's personality. And I don't want to focus too much on that film because that's not what we're talking about.
Definitely not.
But Fox is a much lighter fare. But yet, once again, still a kid's film really geared towards adults.
Yes. And did you find that it was a little hard to watch in some spots? It was almost like the Transformers effect for me a little bit. Like the way they moved, it was like kind of jerky and getting used to.
Yeah, but I believe, and you probably feel the same way, that was entirely all on purpose.
True.
I think that was all in a way to kind of bring you into that world.
Yeah.
And something, too, we haven't really touched on yet, but I wanted to point out, and I read in a review online, either Entertainment Weekly or perhaps at the AV Club, that essentially Wes Anderson, if you think about it, has been making animated films the entire time. All of his films are very much in their own world.
Right.
And this is almost like a natural progression for him. And after seeing The Fantastic Mr. Fox, I would really be interested in seeing what he's going to come up with next, especially if it's another animated film.
Yep. All right.
Excellent. So I'd have to say we both enjoyed it. We'd definitely recommend seeing it, though I'm not sure how much longer it's going to be out in the theaters, especially as the holidays roll around.
Yeah.
But if you get a chance to at least maybe check it out when it comes out on DVD.
Yep.
And that's our discussion for that. So we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back, and then we'll discuss quickly what's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray this upcoming Tuesday. So hang tight.
What you give? Oh, give out. It's the only thing that really counts. Will you stay?
I'd like to welcome you back to The First Run. I'm Chris Pediscalzo.
I'm Matt Howell.
And now we're going to quickly discuss some of the upcoming DVD and Blu-ray reviews that will be out this Tuesday. First up, the smash comedy hit of the summer, The Hangover, starring Bradley Cooper, Ed Helms, Zach Galifianakis, and that other guy.
Right. Who's the other guy?
The guy they have to... You haven't seen the film, have you, Matt?
No, I have not.
Well, I don't want to ruin it for you. So it's an unrated version of that'll be coming out. There's going to be also one of the cool little features. There's going to be more photos from the missing camera, where at the end of the film they find this camera that has all these incriminating photos of their trip to Vegas. And hopefully maybe more disturbing photos of Zach Galifianakis's, area. If anybody's seen the film, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Now, though I enjoyed The Hangover, not not quite as good as my favorite comedy of the year. And I don't want to get too much into it because we'll be discussing our upcoming, our favorite films, I should say, from 2009. And I'm still a little bitter of everybody who I tried to organize a night to go see it and nobody could go. Well, I shouldn't say that.
Well, it's because we're not that fond of you, Chris.
Fair enough. But dear friend of the show, Chris Esposito, who will be stepping in every now and then as well, he did go see it, and he enjoyed it immensely as well. That film, of course, is
Black Dynamite.
Black Dynamite, exactly. That should be coming out on DVD and Blu-ray early next year, so I'm sure you're all excited.
I'm excited.
Funniest film movie I've seen in years. Don't really. I swear to
God. I don't know about your sense of humor, though.
My sense of humor is very strong. Thank you. I'm not going to sit here and be insulted by a man who thinks, along with the French, Jerry Lewis was the funniest man who ever lived. That wasn't even remotely funny at all. So let's move on. Next up coming up.
It'll take you long enough to think about that, too.
Next up is Tuesday, potentially also maybe could end up on Matt and I's one of our favorite movies of the year. Out on DVD and Blu-ray, Tarantino's newest film, Inglourious Basterds. It's going to include extended and alternate scenes, the full feature version of Nation's Pride, a roundtable discussion with Quentin Tarantino, Brad Pitt for the ladies, and for Matt, and Elvis Mitchell. As well, there'll also be the documentary, The Making of Nation's Pride, a bunch of other little features, and there'll also be a digital copy so all the kids can burn it to their iPod. Matt, are you excited for Inglourious Basterds?
I'm very excited for Inglourious Basterds. I cannot wait to watch it in Blu-ray, see all the blood. Really, the colors in that movie are going to be fantastic. I can't wait to see it.
Still my favorite scene in that whole film, and I'm spoiling it, I'm sure, is the projection of, I won't say too much, but the projection of her face on the smoke at the end of the film.
It's pretty sweet.
That is an image that'll stay with me, just beautifully shot. And of course, for us baseball fans, specifically Yankee fans, the official 2009 World Series DVD will be released Tuesday as well.
I'm making an inappropriate hand gesture right now, around below the waist somewhere, just to say how I feel about that.
You don't even follow baseball.
Doesn't matter. We shouldn't be talking about
it. Do you even know that it's a sport?
I've heard of it before.
Fair enough. Well, I'm glad to then have your well-educated input.
Right, like any of our opinions are well-educated.
Well, that's what's coming out next Tuesday, this upcoming Tuesday, just in time for the holidays. Make sure you get the little kids Inglourious Basterds. They're going to watch it on Christmas Day while they're opening presents. And we're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back and talk about the newest film by one of my favorite directors, Chark Pan Wook, in his vampire film, Thirst.
What's the verb to cut it off to take a knife and hack away at it? You keep saying, well, that's the last time you'll pretend to stand aside no matter what we did. I'm not playing. Oh, I'm not afraid to.
All right, and we're back to the first run. Now we're going to be discussing a bit of Korean horror. It's K-horror, not J-horror.
Correct? Correct, yes.
Okay. We're going to be discussing a little bit of K-horror called Thirst. It's a vampire movie from the land of South Korea. Basically about a priest who has a blood transfusion and becomes a vampire, correct?
Essentially, yeah. The actor is Song Kang-ho, and he essentially plays a priest who's done. He's upset that there's so much just sickness and suffering in the world. And he doesn't know really what to do about it. So he volunteers for this experiment to help fight this virus known as the Emmanuel virus. And almost everybody who takes the vaccine. See, well, in my magical world, they're all the same thing. But almost everybody who takes a vaccine dies, as does he.
Right.
He dies a horrible death, but he comes back to life.
Right.
And when he comes back to life, now he is essentially a vampire.
Right. I did not like this movie at all.
Really?
No, I hated this movie.
Why? What makes you? Is there anything? Well, let's try and be diplomatic.
All right.
Is there anything you can say that you did enjoy about the film? Let's try and start. Let's be positive.
Okay. We're gonna do the criticism sandwich.
Positive, sure.
Negative, positive.
That would be awesome.
All right. Thank you. I mean, it looks really good. I mean, it was shot very, very well.
It is beautiful.
I mean, and if you take it, it's one of those movies, and I hate these kind of movies, but it's one of these movies, if you take it as little vignettes or little short stories and like little 10-minute chunks, they make sense and they go together and they're, you know, really well done. It's like basically this guy, what's his name? What's the director's name?
Chark Pan-wook.
Yes, I'm sorry. You can tell who's the bigger nerd of us right now. It's like he basically made like 150 10-minute short films and then put them all together into a movie. It had, okay, that's the good thing.
That's the good thing.
Well, no, the good thing is it looked beautiful. It was shot very, very well. The locations were very well done. The framing and the shooting was all beautiful. The cinematography was great.
I want to say, too, the cinematographer was Chung Chung-hoon. And also, I'd like to apologize to our Asian listeners, because I'm sure I am massacring every one of these names.
Yes.
As Matt said, it was a beautifully shot film, as are most of his movies. If anyone's not familiar, some of his other films include the Vengeance Trilogy, which are three of my favorite movies. It's highlighted by Old Boy, followed very closely by Lady Vengeance, and then the original Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. Old Boy, possibly one of the best movies I've seen in the past 10 years. So yeah. I was blown away about that movie.
Yeah.
Every time Chirk Penwick has a new movie coming out, I get excited. He's a very original voice. You don't see a lot of people doing what he's doing.
Right.
And I loved this film. I thought Thirst was fantastic. I loved his little version of vampires, all the little things that he did, like explicitly showing you that this is going to be different. Like, there are scenes where you see, and he shows you this on purpose, where you see his reflection. He sees his reflection in a mirror.
Right.
Just to point out to you that it's not going to be your typical vampire movie. And it's not even, and that's what I like the most about it. It's not a vampire movie.
Right.
Really. This movie is about obsession. That's what this movie is about. Basically, it's about his obsession. His obsession was trying to be a better person, but then having to come to terms with what he is. His obsession with his friend's wife.
Right.
Her obsessions with just trying to have a better life and anything that she's willing to do to have it. And I thought she was fantastic. The actress's name is Kim Ok-Vin, and I thought she was great. Just how she played him throughout the whole film. There's little reveals that I don't want to get too into, but little things that happen throughout this film where you think she's coming at this from a certain angle, but then she does a total 180 and you realize what her true motives are. One of my favorite scenes in the film, there's a part where there's three of the stars in a boat, and she looks over to him and just says very casually, "Do you plan on taking all night?" And I just love the delivery of that line, his reaction of what he has to do. Now, this whole film, Song is a reluctant vampire. He doesn't want to kill anybody. He's very set against it. He satisfies his thirst, if you will, by visiting friends in the hospital and essentially feeding off of their blood bags so he doesn't have to attack anybody directly. He doesn't want to kill anybody. But this woman who he's obsessed with spins this story of how her husband's abusive and he's done all these things and essentially gets him to kill her husband. And then you find out later on, well, maybe some of the things she said to him weren't necessarily the case.
Okay. So now we've had the point, so let's have the counterpoint. Okay, everything that Chris is saying is correct. I mean, the scene that he brought up with the boat was actually the best scene in the movie as far as I was concerned. It was very clever. The dialogue and the structure was the way that they did it. I was like, ah, good for you, director, who I can't remember his name and can't pronounce it. But again, it goes back to my earlier point. You could break that movie up into its 2-hour and 13-minute running time into, you know, a bunch of 10-minute segments, and you could watch them as like little webisodes or something like that. The narrative structure of the movie really left something lacking for me. I mean, it jumps around a lot, and I understand that maybe it's a different, you know, maybe it's just something I don't understand. I don't watch a lot of J-Har or K-Har or that kind of thing. You know, I understand it's a foreign film. You know, they may have a different way of doing things, a different way of telling the story, but the narrative flow left a lot to be desired.
That's true. I think you have a very valid point. I know the film plays a lot on Korean tradition and culture and how things work and how and a point to what you're saying is the movie does kind of veer off from what it originally starts with him being this priest, and he kind of falls out of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of shifts to an issue where they essentially build their own world, the two of them. I love the fact what they did with the house, how they painted everything white and they installed these bright fluorescent lights because now they can't see the sun.
Mm-hmm.
They can't go out during the day.
Right.
So they create this whole environment to try and mirror all of that because they can't really enjoy the real sunlight, which brings me to the ending, which I don't want to talk about. I don't want to give away.
Right.
But I loved the ending of that film.
Yeah. I think my main problem with the movie is if you take it as a whole, it's very unsatisfying. But if you think of it as scenes, it's you know, everything is done extremely well. The ending was great. I would say it's probably second after the boat scene. But, you know, as far as, you know, character development, I mean, the character of the wife of the friend who the priest ends up having an affair with, she starts off as one thing, and then by the end of the movie, she is a completely different person. Now, granted, there are some changing things. I mean, yeah, she becomes a vampire by the end of the movie. But, okay, how much time are we expected to realistically expect to have happened?
She was never, the life she had, she's not a life she ever wanted. She was forced, her parents died, they took her in.
Yes,
and she ended up essentially being forced to marry the son of that woman who took her in. It was at no point, she's always been looking, the way I viewed it, she's always been looking for a way out.
Yeah,
and she sees Song's character as her window out.
Right,
and initially when she finds out he's a vampire, she recoils in horror.
Right,
she wants to get away. She's terrified.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. I mean, okay, maybe it's just my own lack of ability to suspend my disbelief with this, but. And, you know, and granted, maybe I'm looking too much into it. Maybe it's meant more as a fable. Maybe it's meant more as a parable, you know, as a teaching lesson or something like that, as opposed to a straight, you know, this could actually happen. This is a real world kind of thing.
With vampires.
Well, you know what I mean. I don't know. She went from, I understand, I was right up with them with the boat scene, and then... Granted, I guess it could be argued that it's a slippery slope afterwards, but she basically descends into becoming a monster. And before she's literally, and granted, at one point she literally becomes a monster with the becoming a vampire, but, you know, she's, you know, just a foul, foul human being, and that's what it turns out to be.
My thing is that I think in a way she always was.
Well, in that
marriage, because when the priest first comes to stay with them, because what happens is he leaves the church and he has no way to go.
Right.
And what happens is when he dies, he comes back to life and people think he's some type of savior. It's a miracle. They think he's got these healing powers. And he comes to stay with the family. And she essentially seduces him in that scene in the shop down the stairs. So my contention is that she kind of was always that way.
Yeah.
And it's just that now her turn into a vampire let herself essentially... open the doors and let her be who she truly was the entire time.
True. Do you think that he was really... Because it's interesting that you said that he had a crisis of faith. I didn't really see him having a crisis of faith until after he died and came back to life. Like, I didn't see all that before. Like, okay, maybe some questions about it and, like, he wanted to do some things. But I think he didn't have a crisis of faith until he became a monster.
I would agree with that. I think what drives him to get that experimental therapy is to help people. Because he is disillusioned. He does see all the suffering and he doesn't know what he can do about it. that's what essentially makes him volunteer for that experimental therapy, which leads to his death, and then what he becomes and how he accepts it. And that's probably what eventually puts him over the edge. But he's reluctant the entire time. There's no point in this film where he embraces his vampiric, if that's even a term, attitudes or whatever. He never falls in love with it and enjoys it the way she does.
No, he doesn't, but he doesn't apologize for it either. He's basically feeding off of people who are either by the end of the movie, they're asking him to, but he's feeding off people who can't defend themselves, who can't, off of comatose patients.
But he's not killing anybody.
Well, true, he's not killing everybody, but he seems to be justifying it. He's like, I never killed anybody except for, Kong Soon or whatever his name was, who got thrown out of the boat and,
But he did that out of a blinded sense of love and devotion and obsession.
Then what about which was very cool, by the way, where he straightens the corkscrew with his fingers to stab his priest friend and then drinks his blood because he didn't want to have to hear about his friend asking him for the vampiric gift, quote unquote, because he was blind.
Okay. That's true. That's an interesting point.
Maybe I'm giving away too much here, but
so we essentially told you the entire film. There's almost no reason to watch it.
No, there is a reason to watch it. I mean, I think.
I hate to cut you off. Then let's say that. Would you recommend that to somebody? Then you didn't care for it.
I didn't.
But
care
it was
for it.
Beautifully shot.
Yes.
As all of his films are, the color, the framing, everything means something. I would be taken aback from shot to shot, where I just go, wow.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth watching. I mean, you obviously may have a different opinion than I am. You may like this kind of structure, as my friend Chris here does. I mean, it's definitely worth checking out. I mean, it wasn't a horrible movie by any means. I didn't care for it.
It's no Scary Movie 3 or
right,
Twilight, maybe?
The best movie of all time. Greatest.
I think it's a funny, it's scary, it's sweet, it's exciting. I think it's great. It's typical. It's a melodrama. It's a vampiric opera horror. I really enjoyed it a lot. Well, that's our discussion of Thirst, and that was quite a long discussion of Thirst. Much more than the Fantastic Mr. Fox. I can definitely see which one was stirred our passions more. We're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back, and we're going to discuss, in relation to Fantastic Mr. Fox, what our top 5 animated films are of the past decade. We'll be right back.
2, 3...
All right, welcome back to The First Run. This is Matt. We will be discussing a recurring theme. It probably won't be every week, but it will be a feature that we're going to try and do every so often. It's going to be called The Inventory, and this week it's going to be the top 5 animated films of the last decade. So, Christopher, you go first. What do you got?
All right, well, I'm going to start off with my number 5. Recently out on DVD and Blu-ray. I saw it earlier this year. the stop motion animation film from the same people who did Nightmare Before Christmas, Coraline.
Yes.
I was really enjoyed that film. Nice little dark fairy tale. Got a chance to see it in 3D at the theater, and I just fell in love with it. I thought it was a great film.
I really enjoy Neil Gaiman's work, although I have never seen that movie yet. It's on my Netflix queue, though. Fantastic. In my mailbox right now.
That is awesome. What about you? What's your number five, man?
Number five is Shrek. It's a DreamWorks movie. Everybody's seen it. It is funny. It is basically, you know, it's a nice animated film that you can see adults can enjoy, get the little inside jokes, and the kids can also like it as well.
That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. You like that?
That's good.
Yeah.
My number four, the Pixar film, The Incredibles. It's the first Pixar movie outside of old Toy Story, I guess. But that really kind of appreciated on a deeper level than just, oh, look, it's an animated film. How pretty for Pixar. But I really enjoyed The Incredibles, and I think there's talk of a sequel at some point.
Yeah, I think so.
But that's The Incredibles. Not really much more to add. I mean, it is what it is.
It's incredible.
But
all the comic book nerds love that movie.
Exactly, and yes. The Incredibles is my number four.
All right. My number four is a recent movie. It came out this year. It's called Nine. It was based on a short film that I believe was either Oscar nominated or won the Oscar for Best Short Film Animated Film that year. But it's about post-apocalyptic world and these little ragdoll guys basically live in the ruins of society. It was really, really cool. It had a lot of cool visuals, a lot of good action, and just a really interesting and dark storyline that I liked.
That's interesting. I did not get a chance to see Nine. I'll be popping that in my queue. It's also believed by the director. I don't know if he just produced it, but who did Night Watch and Day Watch.
Yes, I think so, yes.
Two great little Russian horror films. Mm-hmm. My number three, won, I believe, the best foreign film picture a couple years ago, Waltz with Bashir, if it was not just past year. No. I think I'm wrong about that. We'll have to do some digging. But Waltz with Bashir is an animated film which turns to live footage right at the end of the film. If you haven't seen it, it's just a movie that'll haunt you. It'll stay with you. It's about this soldier who was in the army, and he was in this Israeli conflict, and he cannot remember what happened. He cannot recall what happened when he was there. So he starts searching out for all of his, I'm not sure what the proper term is, but all of his platoon members, everybody, his company, whatever the case may be. And they all have different little memories, and they kind of fill in his memory of what happened. And the end of the film is a payoff where they show you what happened. And it's a great film, but it's some heavy stuff.
All right. I haven't seen that either. Well, I guess I don't watch a lot of animation. I won't call them cartoons and do them disservice. Okay, so now we're going to have a little run of picks that will be quite obvious for you, for me anyway. Number three, I think my third favorite was Monsters, Inc. If you haven't seen this movie, you must be living under a rock or something. But Monsters, Inc. is about, monsters that come out and scare kids to get power for their monster society. I thought it was a really cool premise. I mean, it's kind of a neat little story as far as, you know, the whole monster society. And I got a little teary. I got a little teary at the end. I'll be honest. Yeah, I did. A little bit.
I like Monsters, Inc. Not in my top five. Maybe at the tail end of my top 10.
Yeah.
I would almost, I hate to say this, would put that under even minor Pixar.
Oh, really?
I haven't seen Cars, but Monsters, Inc. is really near at the end, at the bottom.
That's funny. I would have put The Incredibles under minor Pixar.
Interesting.
I would have. I would definitely put Cars in there as well under minor Pixar, but I think Monsters, Inc. was a good story.
Excellent. Well, my number two is Spirited Away.
Okay.
Just a great little Japanese animated film from a few years ago. Just a great fairy tale about a little girl who gets lost in this other world. And it's just, I can't really, it's one of my favorite films of the past probably 10 years. I was blown away by it. And I had never really gotten into this kind of, I don't know if it's really considered anime, but it's, I just love this film, Spirited Away. If you get a chance, check it out. It's really well done. Another film by the same director, Howl's Moving Castle. Sadly, I've yet to see that. It's in my Netflix queue as well.
Yes.
But Spirited Away is a movie I just love to revisit probably once or so a year. I just never get enough of it.
All right. My number two would be also, hey, guess what? It would be Finding Nemo. I do like Finding Nemo.
Which means I think you and I have the same number one.
Okay, yes. Well, that should probably be pretty obvious with our personalities. But Finding Nemo, I really liked Finding Nemo. Again, if you haven't seen it, you're kind of living under a rock. I just like...
So dismissive to the listeners, but go ahead.
Well, this is our first show, Chris. We have five of them, and four of them are our parents. So, But
you think my mom knows how to work an iPod?
Well, I'm sure you'll download to a CD for her. Probably. And Portia. Hi, Portia. so anyway, Finding Nemo, I just thought it was a... I appreciated just the narrative of it. You know, I appreciated the... I don't know what it is. I'm a sucker for basically creating a whole anthropomorphic world. I thought that was really well done. I mean, the whole society thing. I think I just like how a lot of thought was put into the entire ocean society aspect of it.
And I think we're all pretty familiar with your disturbing fascination with Ellen DeGeneres.
That's very true. Oh, I love her.
Fair enough. My number one, then, what I think a film that was robbed for not being nominated as Best Picture last year. Was it last year or the year before, actually? And in fact, if with the way the Oscars are going now, where they're going to have 10 Best Picture nominees, it would have been nominated. Pixar's WALL-E, one of the best films I've seen in a long time. The fact to have a movie for the first 20 minutes where there isn't an ounce of dialogue, and you don't even notice.
Right.
That movie, you just get carried along. Now, maybe when they get to the ship later in the film, you kind of get brought out of it a little bit.
Yeah.
But the first 20 minutes of that movie, with him alone on Earth, is just, it's just beautiful. It's you forget that you're watching an animated movie.
Yeah. I think that's my number one as well. I thought it was an incredible, incredible film. I thought it was very gutsy to have absolutely no dialogue in the first half hour, you know. And, you know, it was just a simple, you know, this is going to be very, you know, mushy and emo of me to say, but it was just a simple, good story, man. I mean, I was actually literally touched. It plucked on the heartstrings.
It did. The relationship between WALL-E and Eva. Yeah, it gets a little dusty in my apartment every time I watch that movie.
Yes.
I want my own Eva someday. I have some honorable mentions, Matt. I'm not sure if you do as well, but I'd say the first two Shrek films. Yeah. I didn't even bother with the third.
Yeah.
And then the most recent Pixar film, Up, which if you haven't seen Up, you need to prepare yourself for the most depressing first 15 minutes of a movie you will ever see in your entire life.
That was... you know what? Up was really good. I thought while it was depressing, I was really impressed with where they were going with it. But then it just got into just standard Disney fare, I thought, towards the end. And that's what kind of where it lost.
I agree. I kind of got pulled out of it as well for the same reasons. But the first 10, 15 minutes of that movie, the most heart-wrenching scenes I've seen in any movie.
Right.
For a long time. Yeah. Forget animated.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, some films that did not make my list due to time constraints, not being having time to talk about it, but just when they were made.
Right.
And I think Matt feels the same way. The first two Toy Stories and really Iron Giants.
Oh, Iron
Giants. Sadly, both of them from the 90s.
Yeah, sadly, both of them from the 90s. And you know what? I'm going to go ahead and throw out there some other, I don't watch a whole lot of anime, but my three favorites of all time, mm-hmm. Princess Mononoke, Ninja Scroll, awesome, and Akira. If you have not seen Akira, I know it's from 1982 or 1983, but it's an excellent, excellent, incredible movie.
All right, well, that's it. Our top five animated films from the past decade, plus a little extra just for your enjoyment. And that's the wrap-up. I should say that's the inventory.
That is the inventory, yes.
And we're going to take a quick little break and come right back with the wrap-up.
I'm heading back to pack a bag, to head out on the road, to take away what I know is mine. And I'm running down and past the yellow house with Joe, into the breeze where no one seems to care. And I'm feeling the pull dragging me off again. And I'm feeling so small against the sky.
Welcome back to The First Run. This is Chris.
Matt.
And we're just going to wrap things up quickly here. We'll be back next week to discuss the new Cormac McCarthy movie, The Road, starring Viggo Mortensen.
I'm very excited for this one.
I'm as well. I'm a little nervous because it's been pushed back twice now.
Yeah.
With the first push being over a year.
Yeah.
But the reviews have been generally positive, and I'm kind of excited to go see it. Don't forget to check out the website, thefirstrun.com. You can vote in our poll so we can wrap up the poll results for next week. Tell us who your favorite Wes Anderson character is. We'll be back next week with a couple new features, a contest where you'll be able to win a DVD.
Awesome.
And that's it. So thanks for giving us a listen. We appreciate you taking your time, and we'll be back next week.
Bye, all. Okay, I'm talking loudly now. I'm trying to project, so I want the back of the theater to hear me.
I really don't think you are at all. Well, see, wow, look at the difference.
Well, yeah, but I don't talk loud. I mean, I just don't.
Start talking.
I'm talking.
Now project. Talk like you're talking loud.
Go ahead. Talking loud. I don't talk loud. It's impossible.
See, and when I talk loud, look how much higher it gets.
Well, you're just loud and pushy.
Let's see how bad that sounds. I'm Chris Pediscalzo.
And I'm Matt Sotovocho Howell.
You can't do that.